I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Shayla Benaviv, Eugene Meyer Professor of Political Science and Philosophy at Yale University. We're discussing her 2018 book, Exile, Statelessness, and Migration, Playing Chess with History from Hannah Arendt to Isaiah Berlin from Princeton University Press. Benaviv works on contemporary political theory and critical theory, and her books include Situating the Self, Gender, Community, and Postmodernism in Contemporary Ethics, The Reluctant Modernism of Hannah Arendt, The Claims of Culture, Equality, and Diversity in the Global Era, as well as several other books, many edited volumes, and articles. So let me say, first of all, Shayla Benaviv, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure to be here.
So Shayla, this is a great book. I loved reading it. It's a very timely book, too, with the rise of the number of migrants throughout the world and the closing of borders in many Western countries. The book examines the condition of exile and statelessness through the life and works of emigre Jewish intellectuals in the 20th century. And I found this very interesting that you wove together the life and the works of these different thinkers, as well as brought them in conversation in unexpected ways. For instance, Hannah Arendt and Judith Sklar, I didn't realize the kind of connection they had. So this was all great. So thank you for that. Let me ask you, first of all, what was the motivation for writing the book? I want to add that if you could share with us, too, you have an autobiographical motivation, it seems, too, that you mentioned in the first chapter. So maybe if you could say a little bit about the intellectual and the autobiographical motivation for the book.
Right. This book deals with many thinkers who have been quite central to me for a very long time. I mean, Hannah Arendt, most obviously. It's probably the third or fourth time that I engage with her in print. Judith Sklar was actually my colleague when I was teaching, at Harvard, and I was very fond of her, though she represents a kind of liberalism that is not always quite compatible, with mine. She also had an influence on me. Adorno, Theodor Adorno and Walter Benjamin, these are figures from the Frankfurt School, whom I dearly know. The two figures in the book, before I get to the more autobiographical, story behind it, the two figures in the book on whom I had not written before are Albert Hirschman and Isaiah Berlin. And for me, Albert Hirschman's work and life was just an absolute revelation. And in the case of Isaiah Berlin, I knew that he was very contentious about a lot of the others I treat in this book, about Arendt, whose work he had dismissed. But it was also fascinating to me that he also was an emigre intellectual coming to the UK. So if you want, I mean, the book is, as you say, it is about the unexpected dialogue and the intersection of the work of these individuals who are usually treated in separate registers. What made me compose the book, and I look at it as a kind of composition, compose the book the way I did, is revealed in the subtitle, Playing Chess with History. Okay? Books emerge out of arguments, out of puzzles, out of dialogues. This book emerged for me out of a picture. And this was the picture of Hannah Arendt and Walter Benjamin playing chess in their exile in Paris in late 1935. And the book opens with a letter from Hannah Arendt to her husband, Heinrich Blücher, and their correspondence about Blücher being taught by Benjamin, whom they refer to as Benji, and Arendt to learn to play chess. And I mean, what other more wonderful metaphor for the 20th century than this image of Arendt and Benjamin? So I was riveted. I was riveted by this. And I started putting the pieces of the chessboard together, because while Arendt and Benjamin were playing chess, Judith Klar and her parents were leaving Riga, Latvia, first for Sweden, then they went to Siberia, then they ended up in Japan and came over to New York, but could not stay in this country and moved to Montreal. And around the same period, a little earlier, Isaiah Berlin's family had fled the Russian Revolution and they had come to settle in the UK. And the most interesting individual and the piece that just really is sort of like on the chessboard that connected these thinkers for me was Albert Hirschman, who was born in Berlin, but who had fled Berlin by 1933 with his sister to France. And at the time, but he remained a socialist militant, and he fought in the Spanish Civil War. And it is most likely that he was also involved in forging the papers or in preparing the visa papers that enabled Arendt, Blücher, and many others to flee from Nazi-occupied France to Spain and to Portugal, where they came to the United States. So Hirschman was there around, you know, the Pyrenees, helping these emigre intellectuals. So I know this is a lot of historical detail, contextual detail. I mean, I think one way in which this book is somewhat different from my previous work is that it's a bit more contextual and historical. It's something between systematic political theory and intellectual history. Now, what is the autobiographical component, and why do I open with this? I know a lot of people have been, people have been a bit surprised by it, and yet at the same time appreciative, because for a number of years now, and not just with this book, since 9/11, okay, I have been talking about my background. Many people look at my name, Ben Habib. Ben means son of in Hebrew. In Arabic, you can often have bin. A lot of people are like called bin Bella, right? Which is the same name, which is the same root, or you can have Ibn. And Habib is obviously an Arabic last name. The Hebrew is Habib. People who don't know about how close Hebrew and Arabic are sometimes surprised, but these words derive from the same roots. My name alerted me to how I was being perceived in many ways after 9/11. And in another book, Dignity in Adversity, Human Rights in Troubled Times, which appeared about 6 years ago, I talk in that introduction about how I went at the time with my daughter a few days after the September 11th attacks in New Haven to the Red Cross to give blood. And when I gave my name to the nurse, she was a bit taken aback. I could understand. I could see that she thought I was of Arab origin, okay? Since that time, I mean, I tell that story in the introduction to Dignity in Adversity. And since that time, I have been aware of, not only aware of, but I have almost felt a moral obligation to tell who I am and my background and the complexity of the Arab-Jewish relations to which my background testifies. My family are originally from Spain. We are Sephardic Jews. We were persecuted in the 15th century and forced either to convert or to flee. My family background is that our forefathers, and I'm really talking about so many centuries that for many Americans, it's absurd even to have to refer, but you know, this is what I grew up with. 500 years ago, we lived in Spain, and we were persecuted, and we were thrown out of Spain. We came to what was then the Ottoman Empire. And so my forefathers lived in Gallipoli, Salonika, and then, you know, and then Istanbul. But you see, I have a memory of exile, which again, for most Americans, 500 years, what are you talking about? It's unintelligible. But this is what I grew up with. We were Turkish citizens. We were not living in ghettos. We were, you know, integrated into civil society, not fully. We were not fully equal. We did not serve in the army, had very high positions in politics or academia. It is not the story of a successful Jewish integration the way you have in the UK or the United States. But we were not second-class citizens. There was social discrimination, but not political discrimination in Turkey, right? And so I grew up with all these currents going through, you know, my autobiography. And in some ways, of course, I understand vicariously what Hannah Arendt went through, what Judith Clark went through, what all the thinkers I deal with in this volume went through, because part of their exile is, you know, also my own story, though I'm an immigrant and not an exile. I came to this country when I was 19 and a half as a foreign student, and I'm an American citizen now. You know, so I begin the book with this autobiographical story going back to the origins of my family. And to come back to the name, the reason why my name is Ben Habib and my forefathers were called Ibn Habib is because the Jews of Spain were quite well treated during the time of the Muslim kingdoms of Spain, a piece of history that is rarely known, but for, you know, beginning with the 18th century until the 15th, Spain was actually, parts of Spain were Muslim kingdoms, and the Jews of Spain were at that time very well treated. I mean, this is also a story of Jewish-Muslim relations that is rarely known. There is a nice word for it that is called conviviencia. That means living together in harmony. So it's a long story, but...
No, that's great. I find what you're doing so interesting on the political theory side of things, because it strikes me that what you're doing, the sort of interweaving of the life and the intellectual work of these thinkers is something that's not done in contemporary political theory. Often you see, thinking particularly in discussions of multiculturalism, often a very sort of abstract approach to thinking about minority groups. Whereas it strikes me part of what you're doing, and you tell me if this is part of your motivation, is to get more of a sense of concreteness and richness of the lived experience of the Jewish community to really enrich the discussion in political theory. Is that right?
Well, I think that that is an important observation. I mean, since my work on multiculturalism, and I cannot think of culture without history. Now, I think maybe that's what you mean by saying that I don't treat this issue abstractly, but much more, I would say, contextually, because I understand culture as an intergenerational conversation across time and space consisting of competing narratives. It's one way to look at culture. Culture is also material, embedded in things, buildings, etc. But culture is also fundamentally narrative. It is what you're told, and this is something I've learned from Hannah Arendt. The story of who you are is always a story, okay? Mm-hmm. When I ask you, who are you? You tell me a narrative. Where you were born, maybe, what you do, you know, the story. And there are individual and collective narratives. And cultures consist of narratives whereby we identify ourselves as a we across time and space. And these narratives are always contested. A simple example, all right? Think of narratives of American identity. Mm-hmm. Which narrative do we tell? Do we tell your narrative? You are in Texas, you're in a border state. It is hard to think of you without the American-Spanish war, mm-hmm. and, you know, the intermixing of the territories. Do we tell the story of the Puritans? Do we tell the story of the opening of the Western frontier? And these narratives are also part of our political discourse. We fight around these narratives, don't we? Mm-hmm. I mean, you raised the question in our previous interchanges about the discourse today. Political discourse today. I mean, America has gone all of a sudden, instead of defining itself as a country of immigrants, it is now defining itself in terms of the barriers that it erects. I mean, there's always been isolationist tendencies in American history as well. There have always been many. We did not want America to be part of First World War or World War II, etc. But the discourse whereby, the narrative whereby American understands themselves culturally has been predominantly a narrative that has had to do also with immigration, okay? So in that sense, I cannot think of culture without history and without, you know, the competing narratives. And look, some narratives die out. They lose out. They're either forgotten or they no longer have hold on the public imagination. They're no longer convincing, and we just lose them, and they die out. So one of the themes that interests me so much in the book is the narrative about exile, okay? Exile is not a term that is very common in political philosophy or even in the American cultural experience. We talk about migrants. We don't talk about exiles. Exiles are people who are forced to flee and either find refuge somewhere else or they may not. But there is also something called an exilic memory. And Edward Said was very eloquent about this. Now, the interesting thing is that there is an exilic memory that is also part of the Jewish tradition, which is the exile from Israel-Palestine with the destruction of the temple. Okay, mm-hmm. That gets a little bit more theological, but even Arendt herself was aware of this theme of exile in many of her writings. And although she thought it was ridiculous to think that the Jews had to go back, you know, to Palestine, and she lived happily as an American citizen, but she understood and acknowledged this memory of what is called galut, of being in exile. So you see, this is again cultural memory, and probably this does differentiate my approach than that of many other colleagues who write about multiculturalism in different ways. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe you could pursue this theme of exile and Jewish identity a little bit further. This is one of the main themes of your book. At one point in the second chapter, you take up a conversation that debates that among the Jewish intellectuals about the relationship between Judaism and Germany. This is, I mean, the Jewish question is a long-standing question in European history, stretching much before the war. And I found that particularly helpful because it really crystallizes this question about the relationship between particular identities and the general or universal concerns of modern states. So maybe you could say a little bit about the way that Jewish intellectuals and then into Hannah Arendt sort of managed this this tension between maintaining a particular identity and assimilating or seeing themselves as part of a general whole.
Yeah, the second chapter of the book is treats this this question, I hope, both systematically and historically. I received some years ago a prize in the name of a rabbi called Leopold Lucas. I didn't know his work before, and as I started preparing for this prize lecture, I realized that he was a rather influential creator of this movement that is called the Movement for the Wissenschaft des Judentums, or the Science of Judaism. This is the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th. The attempt here was to try to establish the contributions, the intellectual contributions of Jews to German and European culture, etc. And this concept of a science of Judaism, you know, which then became a tradition that people kept coming back to in subsequent years, struck me. And Rabbi Leopold Lucas had, who himself, by the way, ended up dying in a concentration camp, had great hopes for sort of the equality of German Jewish citizens in German culture. And yet, only a few years later, there is this cultural critic by the name of Moritz Goldstein, who writes a well-known essay called German Jewish Parnassus, where he says, forget it. We will never be acknowledged as equals. We will never be part of this culture. And even our scientific and artistic achievements will not make our German colleagues and, you know, co-citizens happy. We will remain as the eternally half other, an incredibly striking phrase that he uses called der ewig half under, the eternally half other. Now, many intellectuals of the period, Hannah Arendt, Walter Benjamin, Gershom Scholem, knew this essay. And they kept coming back to it because it was one of the first essays saying the German Jewish symbiosis, you know, this Parnassus, the mountain of the gods, this is an illusion. And Arendt herself then started developing some of her systematic concepts, like the pariah and the parvenu, reflecting on the dilemmas of Jewish emancipation, or let's say assimilation. What does it mean to be, to want to be other in some form in a European culture? How do you negotiate this? For her, the parvenu was the one who wanted to deny otherness altogether and assimilate, if you wish, the one who wanted to be better than the Joneses. Forget the past. This is who we are. She had no respect for such individuals. Now, the pariah, she said, sometimes could be the outsider who is outcast and does not necessarily define herself as an outsider. And she was very conscious of the fact that pariahdom itself takes an incredible toll on human beings. So she advocated the attitude of the self-conscious pariah. That is to say, the one who is aware of the manner in which culture, the dominant culture, creates one's otherness, and rather than denying it, or rather than being permitted to define, to be defined by the other, you define your own self in a, if you wish, in a more creative way, and out of that source of otherness, you know, you derive some sources of cultural resistance. I mean, one of the funny things that she wrote about this was she thought that Charlie Chaplin was Jewish, which of course he wasn't. But, you know, for her, there were qualities in the pariah, self-conscious pariah, qualities of humanity, generosity, humor, empathy that she thought needed to be cultivated. So from Moritz Goldstein to Hannah Arendt, you go from this idea of the eternally half-other to an aspiration of, you know, self-conscious pariahdom, which becomes a much more creative and self-creative, if you wish, self-defining moment. I conclude with the observation of this discussion that most cultures are hybrid, and culture is hybridity, and this is not just a multicultural invention. I think it is any historian of culture would agree with you about this mixing and conflicting and competing narratives that we go back to. And so I observe that today, in a European culture, the question of the other is not the Jewish other, but it is the Arab or the Muslim other. And I talk about the emergence of hyphenated literature, be it in Great Britain, be it in Germany, be it in France, and the emergence of a kind of immigrant, you know, hyphenated voice.
Right. Yeah, I found this the notion of self-conscious pariah quite interesting and provocative. I mean, a question about it in Arendt is, does she mean to say that the self-conscious pariah is particularly the condition of the Jewish people, or is it that it's a condition of modernity? I could see this as a sort of way in which one could extrapolate this notion to, you say, the modern condition, a condition of alienation, a condition of atomism, in which we're reflectively distant from traditional modes and orders, that in a certain sense we become all pariahs from... does she mean to extend that notion to the modern condition in general, or is this particularly for the Jewish people?
No, I think it is the modern condition. I think it is the modern condition in general. I think that her own reflections emerge out of this specific historical context. But of course, pariahdom, I mean, that is a concept that Max Weber uses in his sociology in terms of pariah religions that are outcast. No, I agree with you completely that it is a condition of modernity, in the sense of being able to negotiate the fluidity of self and other, the definitions of identity, you know, that entail these contentious narratives, also within oneself, and what kind of a stance one takes towards the homogenizing dominant narratives, which deny so much then of the particularity. And so this is Arendt's way of trying to show also the possibility of resistance from within conditions of modernity. And she always, look, one of the hallmarks of her political theory, which I deeply, deeply cherish, is her claim that freedom even under the most unexpected conditions, would emerge, would burst out into the open. Her faith that somehow, even despite totalitarianism, okay, that there would be, that there could be some resistance, and that there could be a moment of freedom saying, it need not be this way, it can be otherwise, it can be different, we can make it different. And this is related to her understanding of the self-conscious pariah in the sense that the self-conscious pariah is not a victim. The self-conscious pariah is someone who tries to rewrite the history of her own otherness and alienation and in creative ways. And I see these moments as very much linked in Arendt. I mean, her, if some may call it romantic, but I think it is a principle of hope that that human freedom emerges, and that a kind of, you know, creativity that cannot be deduced or predicted always comes about and astonishes us again and again.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I've always thought of Arendt in precisely this way, as a kind of heir of the classical German tradition from Kant, Hegel through Nietzsche and so forth. This idea of working through that dialectical relationship to modernity that you described earlier, the sort of moment of immediacy that Rabbi Lucas tries to describe, the sort of moment of commonality to the moment of diremption, to this sort of new moment of a kind of self-conscious creativity. How do you, I mean, I'm just curious, this goes a little bit beyond your book, but since I work on the German tradition, though before Arendt, I'm curious on your views about the relationship between Arendt and her predecessors. You mentioned Kant and the idea of the enlarged mentality in Kant, which I'd love for you to say a little bit more about, but how Arendt viewed some of the other sort of forerunners like Hegel and Nietzsche.
I think that Kant and Nietzsche were exceedingly important for her. I think she had a rather wooden understanding of Hegel. She had a rather dismissive and to my mind not at all sophisticated understanding of Hegel. I'm not at all sure why that's the case, but when she writes about in her essay Tradition and the Modern Age or What is Freedom, it is always Hegel's philosophy of history and world spirit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think she tended to identify Hegel's philosophy with the worst dogmatic historical materialism, mm-hmm. sort of reading, you know, Hegel via a bad version of Marx. So, I mean, there are some interesting snippets and passages about trying to struggle with Hegel's logic of all places in her Denktagebücher, her intellectual remembrance or diaries, her intellectual diaries, right? They haven't been translated, but in general, it's odd. Now, Kant was a permanent influence on her thinking. As we know, one of the last set of lectures that she gave was on Kant's Critique of Judgment. Let me say a bit more about Kant. I mean, it's interesting that what she admires in Kant is not his moral philosophy, nor is it really his epistemology. She doesn't say that much about Kant's first critique. She talks about it a little bit in The Life of the Mind, Volume 1, which is her, the last work before her death. And the third volume was published posthumously. She accepts Kant's distinction between understanding and reason there, and has a rather odd take when she says the understanding meaning our attempt to try to understand the empirical laws of the universe, nature, etc., that the understanding aims at truth, whereas reason aims at meaning. This is not quite Kant either. So, you know, there's always creative thinkers always misread others and, you know, proceed forward, right? Mm-hmm. But the work that is most influential for her, and the work that plays a certain systematic role throughout this book, is the Critique of Judgment. The Critique of Judgment is Kant is a late work, and in some ways it rearranges the pieces of Kant's corpus. But what Arendt found particularly compelling in Kant's Critique of Judgment was several things. First, the distinction between reflective and determinative judgment. Determinative judgment is when you have, let's say, an abstract rule or a concept, and you look at something and you say, ah, this is a circle, you know? In a circle, the center and the circumference are in the relationship of, you know, 2 pi r, right? Remember that from geometry. This is determinative judgment, where the rule or the universal is given, and the task of the intellect is to subsume the universal, to subsume the particular under the universal. Reflective judgment for Kant, which you find in aesthetics, and also, he says, in biology, you know, and in the phenomenon of life, is when the universal is not given, and you have to try to make a judgment about the particular, without being able to subsume it under a general rule. You say, this painting is beautiful. Why? You're going to say, well, I think it's got a marvelous composition. I think the way the painter got the shadow on the rippling waters of the lake is just amazing. So you are assuming that harmony of composition is a criteria of beauty. You are assuming maybe a certain painterly quality is a criteria of beauty, right? But is there a rule that says that? What is the aesthetic rule? Now, Kant says at that point, he makes an incredible move. He says, reflective judgment is not arbitrary. Reflective judgment is when I have to submit my judgment to the evaluation and Zustimmung, consent, not consent, but appreciation or agreement of others. And so that we can build a sensus communis, not common sense, but a sense that is commonly shared. So the hallmark of reflective judgment is my submitting my judgment to the agreement of others for which I must view. Woo. Oh, I'm not pronouncing this word in English very well. It's like wooing someone. What? This is my, you know, how do we say that word? You know what I mean?
Right, woo.
W-O-O.
Yeah.
Huh?
Woo.
I-N-G, mm-hmm. Right, this word, right. So it's like you can't force somebody into agreeing with you. You can't cheat them. You must ask for their agreement. You woo them, right, the way you would woo somebody whom you liked, right? Arendt thought this was absolutely fantastic. And what she saw there was a kind of core idea for what happens in the political public sphere. Okay, although, you know, Kant did write a kind of philosophy of law, metaphysics, metaphysical elements of justice, She didn't focus on that. She focused on this idea of reflective judgment, of being able to judge as one she puts it, when the chips are down. Mm-hmm. And she always says the chips are down because of her German accent. And, you know, there are recordings of this. But when the chips are down, that is to say, when I cannot rely on any universals, you know, church, state, traditional concepts of morality, and I must judge for myself, is reflective judgment. And I must try to engage in a conversation, try to engage with others in order to make this kind of sensus communis possible. Arendt thought that this was Kant's political philosophy. This was Kant's political philosophy, and this question of judgment, you know, keeps coming up throughout her work, and I also go into some detail about why, for Adorno, as well, whom we haven't talked about at all, that Adorno, who really has an aesthetic philosophy, and, you know, he really also struggled with this question of the Naturschön, the naturally beautiful. He didn't think this was a very good criteria of the aesthetic, but he acknowledged that in aesthetics there is that kind of judgment at work that produces for us certain kind of paradigmatic evaluations, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the long story with Kant. Now, with Nietzsche, there are several approaches to this, and some Arendt scholars like Dana Villa, Bonnie Honig, emphasize Arendt's critique of modernity in the case of Dana as being indebted to Nietzsche. And in the case of Bonnie Honig, the question of essence and appearance and Arendt being interpreted as a kind of performative thinker, if you wish, even before that notion becomes so popular. That is to say, that supposedly what Arendt takes from Nietzsche is this idea that there is no doer behind the deed, and that it is, you know, all, you know, the realm of action, the public sphere in which we exist and we are seen, and so on. I don't disagree with that, though. You know, I have criticized reading Arendt as a theorist of performativity, because clearly Arendt has a much more, it's not essentialist, but she does think that the person is revealed in performance, so there is something behind the performance, and it is not she's not a complete anti-essentialist, so I don't think that move quite works. I haven't talked about her Nietzsche analysis in the second volume on Willing, which doesn't play a role in this book. I've subsequently done a long essay on it, but
yet another conversation when that essay comes out, and yes, we can talk about it. That'd be good. I wanted to jump ahead to talk about sort of more, I guess, more particularly about Arendt's views on refugees and her famous claim that we have a right to have rights. You devote a chapter to her, that claim, and develop and defend it. I was hoping that you could expand on it. What is this notion of the right to have rights, and right, how you think that it, you claim that it's sort of can play a significant role in our thinking about refugees, and could you expand on that?
Sure. It is actually a remarkable phrase that keeps a sort of gaining more and more in relevance as time goes by rather than is less. Arendt, reflecting on her own historical experience of statelessness, reflecting on the European disaster in between the wars where millions of people were rendered stateless, and you know that is denaturalized, their citizenship was revoked, and they became refugees in part because they could not stay in their homeland, you know, their citizenship was revoked, whatever. In reflecting on these conditions, she comes up with this remarkable phrase that she says, the stateless are not denied the ordinary rights of speech and action and having a place in the world. They are denied the right to have rights. Now, what exactly does the right to have rights mean? There are several ways of parsing it. To have rights, once you are recognized as a member of a political entity, it's what we would refer to as civil and political rights, rights of your citizenship. The rights that you have as an American citizen, the rights that I have, which are also imbricated or implicated in human rights. But what is the right to have rights? It is the right to be recognized as a member of a political entity. This is one way to read it. You might say the right to have rights is the recognition of you as belonging to a political community. Okay? So you can understand it as a right to membership. But there's also another dimension to it. The other dimension to it is the right to be recognized as a person entitled to a bundle of rights, regardless of your nationality. So this gets into the question that the right to have rights is about the status of personality in international law in our days. Now, what does this mean? One of the most important developments in the post-war period, be it with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, be it with the international covenants that get then stipulated on human rights in the 60s, building up on the Universal Declaration, and the Geneva Conventions of 1951, are the recognition of the status of the person as a person of the individual independently of national citizenship. This means that the right to have rights is in some ways about international human rights. This is not always discussed in Arendt scholarship. I think that I am correct in pushing the issue in this direction, because there have been revolutionary transformations in the law as a result of the experience of Holocaust, genocide, etc. Specifically, what does this mean for one's refugee status? Okay? A refugee, according to the 1951 convention, is a person who has fled their country of origin or find themselves in a position of not being able to return on the basis of persecution on the grounds of race, color, religion, social membership, or political belief. Okay? What do we owe refugees? All right, this is called the convention definition. But what do we owe refugees? Already in Article 14 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it is stated that all human beings have a right to asylum in cases emerging from genuine persecution, right? So if you are an ordinary felon or if you are a war criminal, whatever, you can't just flee to another country and request asylum. But if you are one of the individuals persecuted on these bases, you have a right to seek asylum. And what asylum means in the first place is non-refoulement. You cannot be rendered to the country from which you are seeking escape. So this is complicated. It means that states agree to have inter-boundary obligations to one another, okay? So if you flee Mexico because you are persecuted and, you know, you come to Texas, under the International Refugee Convention, you have a right, universal, recognized in the Universal Declaration, etc., to say, I am seeking refuge because I am being persecuted, because I refuse to join this gang, or I'm a gay individual, or I'm a Jehovah's Witness, whatever have you, okay? There is an obligation on the part of the receiving state to prove or to examine your claim to asylum. The obligation, though, is not to return you to the country from which you are seeking escape. Now, there are state parties to the Geneva Convention. The way international law works is that when a convention is articulated, states need to sign up to it, and this has to be ratified. This gets very complicated, but I want to talk a little bit about the United States because it's the reality that we are living with today. In some countries, international law immediately becomes the law of the land. These are called monistic systems. For example, the Netherlands, for example, South Africa. In the United States, international law becomes the law of the land. It requires congressional ratification. To give you an example, the Genocide Convention of 1948 was not approved or ratified by the United States Senate before about 1981-1982. Okay? The United States is a high party to the Geneva Convention and absorbs the Geneva Convention into its own immigration law, but like most states, it tries to dance around its obligations. For example, one of the criteria that is now introduced is refugees have to come to a recognized port of entry. What constitutes a recognized port of entry? You know, states can play games, and the games that are being played right now under the Trump administration is, you know, to assert, number one, that the refugees are raising false claims, and therefore their asylum applications will probably be in large measure denied, okay? Because they are said to be escaping not from conditions of violence and persecution, but other grounds. And there comes now the question of the separation of families and children. This is completely against international law, and it is against this Flores Amendment, where, you know, underage children cannot be kept in detention camps and so on. I mean, it is just, to me, it is just astonishing what has happened. And there is a whole industry now of detention camps, you know, particularly in Texas, that have been constructed around this cockamamie interpretations. But here we have the conflict between power and law. I mean, the United States is the hegemon. You know, so to come back to Arendt's concept, I know this may seem a roundabout way, but it isn't, of the right to have rights. You can interpret it narrowly as a right to citizenship, as a right to belonging, to naturalization, or you can interpret it more broadly, the way I do in my own thinking, as the emergence of a right to universal personhood in international law. And then you can see how some of the refugee conventions and so on come in.
Yeah, and I agree with you on your assessment here. I mean, it's unclear to me what exactly the basis of some of the strong claims to sovereignty that, say, the United States makes about this. I mean, I think I'm more schooled in the classical liberal tradition. I mean, even on the classical liberal view, say on somebody like Locke, the earth belongs to humankind in common. So it's not as if, you know, even on a you know, classical liberal view, there isn't a strong claim to sovereignty, that the claim about the earth belongs to humankind in common always stands underneath any of these kinds of claims. So if you have someone in the state of nature who doesn't have a home, all the nations on earth have a duty to welcome such an individual. Or you could say somebody like Kant has a view about hospitality.
Right, cosmopolitanism.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, maybe on this point, I mean, how do you think Arendt's views about the right to have rights sort of compare and contrast with some of these more classical liberal views? Are they, do you see them as, I guess, do they cohere with one another, or would Arendt disagree with anything in particular with the sort of state of nature-y, contractualists, more standard view of these things?
I think that she did not think that the classical liberal tradition had a very coherent justification of human rights. And that's why she says, you know, I mean, she's very doubtful about the concept of nature to ground anything, because nature, you know, as we know, it's always ambivalent between fact and norm. So when we talk about human nature, do we mean the facticity of human beings, or do we mean reason? And reason is also being part of human nature, and there is always some kind of a conflict between the natural impulses of man in the liberal tradition and the irrational impulses. So Arendt thought that this conflict made the concept of nature, in a sense, quite useless. That's why she substituted a concept called the human condition. That is to say, it's almost like the circumstances of justice. Natality, we are born, we die, plurality, we exist among others, like ourselves, we exist on the earth, and we build a world together that we share through speech and action. So this is like, if you wish, her alternative ontology to the talk about human nature in the natural rights tradition, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and Kant starts trying to distinguish it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And she's also very dismissive of the concept of sound, basing anything on the concept of history. It's like, you know, she rejects any teleology of history, and this is her bad reading of Hegel as a naive philosopher of world history. So what the foundation of the right to have rights is in Hannah Arendt, I've worked a great deal on this. I think she's an anti-foundationalist thinker, and there is an existentialist strain in her where she says we are not born equal. We create equality by establishing communities with one another and, you know, recognizing each other as equals, okay? So it's the establishment of a political association or community that creates the moral equality among us. But I think one should try to give some kind of a philosophical justification. But I've done that in my other work, you know, on communicative freedom and so on. So she's, of course, aware of Kant's concept of hospitality, which I interpret almost as the first articulation as the right of asylum, when Kant says in his essay on perpetual peace, you know, the law of world citizenship is you know, not to deny the stranger to visit your land when it can be done, or to stay on your land when it can be done without when it can be done without causing his destruction, right? Or that there is an obligation, that there is an obligation to receive the stranger and not to turn the stranger away. But Kant compromises there and says, well, the stranger can stay a certain amount of time, but whether he or she can stay a long time, that depends on sovereign prerogative. Mm-hmm. So Kant sort of splits splits the middle in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, we share the earth in common, mm-hmm. but there are limits once sovereign boundaries have been established.
Right, yeah. Right. So we're just about coming up to an hour, and we've talked only about Arendt. So I'm sorry, but I wanted to ask you though about Judith Sklar, particularly about her critique and relationship. Well, earlier she sort of had a more positive view of Arendt than sort of changed her view to be more critical. But you could talk a little bit about, because I think for listeners are probably fairly familiar with Judith Sklar's version of liberalism, but I think probably less familiar with her relationship to Arendt.
Well, as I point out in the chapter, Judith Sklar wrote about 5 times on Hannah Arendt, and some long, some short. Some were review essays, but some were fairly comprehensive discussions of Arendt's views. And there's no question that Arendt loomed as the political philosopher of her generation. I mean, maybe even more so than Leo Strauss. But Sklar was more of a liberal, and I don't mean just the liberalism of fear, which is a late work, and I think in some ways it's a captivating phrase, but I think in some ways it reduces the complexity of Sklar's thinking. Sklar was a liberal in the tradition that took the rule of law extremely seriously. And her first... It's not her first book, it's her second book. I think the book that really reveals her intellectual power is Legalism, written in 1962. And Legalism is about a certain mentality in reducing the rule of law to a set of determined provisions that then seem to be mechanically applied. Legalism is a term that both describes a certain attitude of the practitioners of the legal profession. It seems to describe a certain way of conceiving of moral philosophy as just simply a mechanical application of axioms. You know, a kind of, if you wish, vulgar Kantianism. Mm-hmm. Think of the categorical imperative, right? But she also conceived of legalism as a kind of mistaken ethos about the relationship of law and politics. And she discussed in this respect the Nuremberg trials. It was her counterpart to Arendt's discussion of the Eichmann trials, I believe. And in the Nuremberg trials, I mean, the problem was that when the Nazis were accused or judged under the category of crimes against humanity, such a category did not really exist in international law. There is war crimes that existed for quite some time, but how is humanity as a subject of criminal international law, we would say today, right? And Sklar admitted that the concept of crimes against humanity was somewhat created whole cloth. But she thought that this was a justifiable invention and that it was legalistic to just think that the Nuremberg trials had to be conducted according to existing war crimes category and that the category of crimes against humanity was perfectly justifiable. So she has this notion also of the creative ethos of the law. By the way, this is something that drives lawyers crazy. because, you know, they think that this is post-fact justice. And in fact, many German lawyers said, what is this category called? Crimes against humanity, it's hocus pocus, or it's moral philosophy. It's not law, because where do you find it? So Sklar, throughout, I think, her writing, was struggling with the proper ethos of the relationship between law and politics. And therefore, to reduce her to the liberalism of fear is not right. It's also not right to reduce her to a simple defense of a liberalism of rights. Okay, she was as ambivalent about all the language of natural rights as Hannah Arendt was. And she rarely argues with that concept in her work. I mean, when you look at one of her later works, which I like a lot, American Citizenship, right? What constitutes American citizenship? She says, it is also the status of being a member of civil society by being able to earn a living. That the standing that one has as an American citizen is very much tied in to the capacity to be able to make one's own living and so on, which is very different than saying, you know, we have a universal human right to income or whatever. I mean, this may explain maybe also why she greatly respected John Rawls's work, A Theory of Justice, but she would never argue in the same way in political philosophy. She was much more contextual and much more of a historian of ideas in her judgments about politics. But I think she comes back to Arendt again and again, and in particular because I think she really disagreed with Arendt's analysis of the law, and she didn't think that Arendt quite understood the nuances and so on of the legal system very well. And another respect in which Sklar is really quite original, and this differs greatly from Arendt, is that Sklar was very much a moral psychologist or a political psychologist. She paid great attention to the workings of human passions and human sentiments. You know, a book that I don't discuss that much called Ordinary Vices, for example. Yeah.
Well, this has been great, Sheila. I wish we had more time to talk about Albert Hirschman and Isaiah Berlin, which you talk about in two more chapters. But I fear that would take us another hour or so.
Absolutely.
But you've been really, really generous with your time, and I really appreciate it. So thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. I enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes.
Thanks to the Association for Political Theory for promoting the show.
And thanks to you for listening.